silence. Try to take breaks every 90 minutes if possible, or whenever a natural break shows itself. Before we get started today, any changes to the agenda, any recommendations to change the agenda? Any comments on the agenda? Okay, seeing none, we'll get right into the first agenda item, reports, and we'll go to the executive director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. First thing, when you move your microphone, could I ask you please not to touch the microphone itself when you move it? We're replacing an awful lot of them, so just move the base or and adjust the neck, but don't touch the microphone. Thanks. Second thing, under tab one, correspondence number four, you'll see a memo about policy for council certification of draft regulations. You were all handed out our new handbook that you approved at the last council meeting. So as we make changes, we'll send you copies to add to the three-ring book. And the first change would be, as you recall, we had a motion last council meeting to approve regulations that go forward with our plan by deeming them necessary and appropriate. And I'd like to make this a permanent policy. So on number four, you see policy for council certification of draft regulations associated with FMP actions. And if you read down, I'd make that right into the format for our policy that basically follows what we did at the last council meeting for, I think it was Scollops. So if you want to read that, and approve that, that would be our policy. And while you're reading that, I want to mention to Gene. Gene, attached to that number four is Scallop Framework number 19. And on the second page, page 14749, you'll see in brackets where it says that proposed rules, regulations as drafted by NOAA Fisheries Service, which included regulations proposed by NOAA Fisheries Service under the authority of Section 305D of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and deemed them to be necessary and consistent with the section of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, Section 303. So that talked about that the council deemed the proposed rules necessary and appropriate. It was the first time it appeared in regulations. But I think it's very confusing to the public, because right after that, there's mention of the service disapproving. But it doesn't, in my opinion, it leaves the public with the question, well, did the council agree with that or not? And then it adds another question about, well, should we comment on that after you've, you know, so this deeming necessary and appropriate. First thing I'd rather do is leave it out of the proposed rules. We never had it in there before. Do you see what I'm saying? Or if you're going to put it in there that we deem the regulations necessary and appropriate, then go on to say in more detail, however, the service didn't think they were appropriate because of this. But it isn't that clear in here for the public to look at it. So just ask if you'd look at that a little more closely, so it's clear what's being approved or not.
I think that's a fair statement, and we'll certainly try to refine this sort of procedure so that there isn't that kind of confusion, if you think there is.
So, Mr. Chairman, then if folks have read this about our new process for, you know, deeming the regulations appropriate, necessary and appropriate, we would need a motion to approve that as policy.
Is anyone ready to make that motion? Dave Simpson. So moved. Second. Seconded by Rip Cunningham. Discussion. Everybody had a chance to look at the language on the board? Dave Gaethel.
I think is it the third paragraph, it says seconded. I think it should be section.
Thanks, Dave. Anyone else? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed, abstentions, motion carries. Okay, Paul, that was it for you?
Yes, sir.
NIMS Regional Administrator, Pat. Sorry, David Pierce.
Yeah, I've got a question for Paul, and it relates to the manual that he just referenced, the Operations Handbook, and I'm not prepared to make a motion because I need to hear the views of the S&S committee when they give their report relative to a few things that pertains to their operations that are described within this particular manual. The manual itself does not indicate whether or not a quorum is required for the S&S committee to meet and carry out its business. At the S&S committee meeting yesterday, it was mentioned that Gene advised, maybe it was you, Paul, that a quorum is not necessary. I think it is, but that's my own personal view. In addition, there was an open meeting yesterday of the S&S committee. Clearly, they were here in this room, and they met, and it was a good meeting. But it was also indicated that there was going to be a breakfast meeting this morning, potentially. I don't know whether that happened, but that's not an open meeting. So I just wanted to alert the council to these concerns of mine regarding a quorum and regarding meetings being completely open. That is, the public can be present to listen to the discussions. I'm not making any motion at this time. I'll just wait until the S&S committee gives this report and see if they have any perspectives regarding those particular issues. And then I'll be guided by those particular SSC perspectives, and then perhaps later on during the course of our meeting, I'll be prepared to make a motion, maybe under other business.
In terms of, you know, I was again, I was concerned that we didn't a lot of folks couldn't make our first meeting, so I asked Gene about the quorum. And so the legal opinion was that the SSC is giving us advice. The only quorum requirements are for the council to take action. We need a quorum to take action. That was the legal interpretation. And the second thing we did, this was out of the ordinary, this first meeting, to have a breakfast meeting. However, we did note that, to my knowledge, we noted it on the announcement and set up chairs so that the public could also go there as they wrestled with the report writing. So it was noted that the public could attend that breakfast meeting.
Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Starting with multi-species and announcements on multi-species, a final rule published in the Federal Register on March 28th, specifying the total allowable catch levels for the 2008 fishing year for the U.S.-Canada management area. The rule also includes a provision to postpone the fishing year 2008 opening of the eastern U.S.-Canada area until August 1st. For trawl vessels, longline gear vessels are allowed to fish in that area during May through July period, with a cap on the amount of cod caught during that period set at 5% of the cod tack. A final rule published in the Federal Register on March 28th that approved the Georges Bank cod hook sector for fishing in 2008. Total of 19 vessels would be participating and would be allocated 6.44% or 658 metric tons of the 2008 fishery-wide Georges Bank cod tack. A final rule published in the Federal Register on April 10th that approved the Georgia's Bank cod fixed gear sector for 2008. That sector has a total of 29 vessels and will be allocated almost 14% or 1,430 metric tons of the 2008 fishery-wide Georgia's Bank TAC. We are currently preparing a rule that will propose the eliminator trawl for use in the regular B Days at Sea program and the Eastern U.S. Canada Haddock SAP. We hope to have the proposed rule for that published by early May. Summary on the Days at Sea leasing program: between May 1, 2007 and April 9, 2008, total leases processed 676. Total leases approved, 644. Number of distinct permits, 625. Total days at sea leased, 13,899.79. The regulations require that we consult with the council prior to adding any proposed exemption under the multi-species 5% rule, for lack of a better name. We are at this point proposing modifications to the three existing scallop exemptions by establishing incidental monkfish catch limit of 50-pound tail weight per trip, and that's within the Gulf of Maine scallop dredge exemption area, the Southern New England scallop dredge exemption area, and the Great South Channel scallop dredge exemption area. So this is your opportunity to comment. As I said, we're consulting with you on these proposals, so appreciate it if you could provide any comments you had at the end of my report. On sea scallops, the comment period on the proposed rule for Framework 19 closed on April 8th, and we're preparing a final rule for that action now. On Amendment 11, the final rule for Amendment 11 published in the Federal Register on April 14th and is going to be effective on June 1st with the exception of the new permit requirements, which we've delayed till July 1st to allow people an opportunity to get those permits. Monkfish, the comment period in the proposed rule for Framework 5 ended on March 25th. The final rule is under development. On herring, there's a letter in your binder that I received from Terry Stockwell on behalf of the ASMFC herring section, and my response to that letter, Terry's letter expressed concern over the increasing Canada's New Brunswick weir fishery in 2007 and also requested initiation of discussions on a resource sharing agreement between the U.S. And Canada. My letter in response to Terry explained that I had met with Faith Scatalon, who is my counterpart in the Maritimes region, in early January and had expressed those same concerns about the increase in landings in the weir fishery. Faith informed me that the Minister of Fisheries in Canada had recently announced that he had asked their Fisheries Resource Conservation Council to undertake a study of the herring fishery in Canada, a comprehensive study on that fishery, and that until that study was completed, they would be involved in that and unwilling to enter into any kind of discussions on sharing arrangements. She also mentioned, however, that there was industry interest in having industry-to-industry discussions in the interim. Let's see. Herring. On protected resource issues, I just wanted to fill you in a little bit on the harbor porpoise take reduction plan activity that's going on right now. We've had two harbor porpoise take reduction team meetings now. Since 2004, the bycatcher harbor porpoise in both New England and mid-Atlantic gillnet fisheries has exceeded the potential biological removal level, despite implementation of the 1999 harbor porpoise take reduction plan. Additionally, in the mid-Atlantic, takes were documented outside of the area affected by the plan. So we anticipate that for the mid-Atlantic, we're discussing with the take reduction team measures to address this PBR, exceeding the PBR. In the mid-Atlantic, we expect that it will result in another management area south and east of the current mud hole closure area. In New England, in addition to the takes outside of the existing harbor porpoise management areas, most of the increase in bycatch appears to be due to poor compliance with the PINGR requirements of the harbor porpoise plan. We, in cooperation with the states, initiated an extensive outreach and enforcement program in 2006, and in December 2007, reconvened the take reduction team. For New England waters, the team has recommended expansion of harbor porpoise management areas and seasons, as well as the development of quote-unquote consequence closure areas, areas that would be closed to gillnet fishing if the average of 2 years of observed bycatch rates within harbor porpoise management areas exceeds the bycatch rates expected on observations of gillnet gear with correctly deployed pingers. These and other measures discussed by the team will provide the basis for an EA and proposed rule to modify the take reduction plan anticipated for publication in late June. The personnel from our Protected Resource Office are going to provide a complete briefing on this at your June council meeting. Also under Protected Resources, we recently completed a Section 7 consultation and new biological opinion on the scallop fishery under the Atlantic Sea Scallop Fishery Management Plan. The biological opinion concluded that the continued authorization of the scallop fishery may adversely affect, but is not likely to jeopardize, the continued existence of loggerhead, leatherback, Kemp's Ridley, and green sea turtles. However, sea turtles are expected to be captured, injured, and or killed as a result of physical contact between sea turtles and scallop dredge and trawl gear used in the fishery. As a result of that, we're required to do an incidental take statement. So the biological opinion includes an incidental take statement, and the ESA requirement is that an incidental take statement must include reasonable and prudent measures to minimize the impacts, that is, the amount or extent of incidental take. We've sent a letter to Paul just last week. Is this in the binder? I don't remember. I don't know if the letter is in the binder or not, but anyway, it outlines the results of the biological opinion and speaks to the issue of the reasonable and prudent measures that have been recommended and the terms and conditions to implement those. It includes a reasonable and prudent measure that requires that no later than the 2010 scallop fishing year, the number of open area scallop days at sea that can be used and the number of area access trips that can be taken each year in waters south of the northern boundaries of statistical areas 612, 613, 533, 534, and 541 through 543, the number of days at sea used and access if trips taken need to be reduced, and I'm not going to go through the details. It's all available in the letter. Okay. Let's see. We had a Northeast Region Coordinating Council meeting on April 1st and 2nd, right here, actually. And a number of agenda items that may be of note to this council. We had a considerable discussion on the SSC process, both within the council process itself and how that was going to work within the two councils. And we also talked about the SSC process in terms of the role of the SSC and the SAW-SARC process. We did SARC scheduling, which I think Nancy might be talking about. I gave the NRCC an update on our transition to the new Days at Sea tracking system. We are in the process, as most of you know, of trying to revise our Days at Sea tracking system. We're in our third version now. We actually ended up throwing out the first two versions and starting completely from scratch in the third version. It didn't seem that there was any way to continue to fix the versions that we had, and part of that has to do with constantly changing requirements in that program, and as well as the complexity of the system at this point. We're hopeful that this new system is going to work much better than the previous two, and will finally allow us to provide web-based Days at Sea balances. Our target is rollout of this new system sometime this summer. I also informed the Northeast Region Coordinating Council that NOAA has implemented a national policy on the collection of permit fees. And in this region, we've determined that vessel permits, dealer permits, and operator permits will all ultimately require fees. We believe we have the regulatory authority to collect those fees right now, but it will require changes, Paperwork Reduction Act changes, as well as changes to our infrastructure in order to support collection of the fees. And so we don't have a date yet for when we'll be implementing that requirement. Let's see. We had a presentation on our investigation of concerns with the fishery-dependent data collection systems, and you're going to have that presentation tomorrow, so I won't spend any time on that. And then finally, the NRCC stayed for a National Marine Fisheries Service-sponsored MRAP listening session. That's the Marine Recreational Information Program replacement for MRFs. Gordon Colvin and several members of the staff working on the new MRAP system came and gave presentations and solicited input from the participants of the NRCC. And did Harbor Porpoise. That's it.
Okay. One of the items Pat mentioned was a change to the exemption for retention of monkfish in the scallop fishery. Is that right?
Yes.
And you're hoping members of the council or the public could comment on that? Okay. So we can start with that issue. If people want more of an explanation of what the proposed change is, perhaps we could get that. If people want to make comments, this would be a good time. Okay. Anything else? Anyone have any questions for Pat? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Pat, thank you for mentioning the correspondence between you and Terry Stockwell as to what's happening in Canadian waters. The herring catch, 31,000 or so from Area 1A. Our quota is 45,000. The Canadians took 31,000 last year. So clearly we're coming to a clash. You indicated that in your communications with your counterpart in Canada, she said, and I think she said that before any action can be contemplated, that there would be the need for a study of the herring fishery in Canada. Was that how you worded it? And if I'm correct, then did she give you any indication as to when that study would be accomplished this year, next year, within the next 10 years? Also, you indicated that industry-to-industry discussions might be useful. If that's the case, have you given any thought to when those discussions might occur?
The study I referred to was actually initiated. There was a press release issued on January 16th of this year by the Minister of Fisheries in oceans in Canada. He was announcing that he had requested the Fisheries Resource Conservation Council, the FRCC, Canada's FRCC, to develop a long-term strategic approach to Atlantic herring conservation. And this study is similar to a couple of others that have been done, and the most recent one, I think, was a lobster one that people may be familiar with. But the FRCC has been asked to look at the complete range of issues associated with herring, from science to management to public policy type issues. And so, as I said, the study was initiated with his announcement in January. The press release says that the report from the FRCC is expected back in June 2009. Now, the report goes back to the minister, who then, I think, sends it to DFO so that they can provide comments back to the minister on the report before he makes any final decisions based on it. On the industry-to-industry, we decided to leave it up to the industry. It would not be government-sponsored. The discussions.
So leave it up to industry. Is it necessary to provide guidance to the industry as to how they should go about doing that based upon previous industry-to-industry get-togethers?
Well, the herring industry in particular for quite a long time did hold industry-to-industry meetings, and so our assumption was they would just resume those.
Okay, thank you. And then a follow-up with what you said about timelines. It appears, therefore, that we'll have, obviously, 2008, 2009, and 2010, most likely, with status quo, in that the Canadians will take what they choose to take and we'll be living with our 45,000 or whatever it may happen to be in the future. So it's unfortunate, but in light of the significance of that catch by the New Brunswick weirs, but I had hoped that it's considering the size of that particular catch and the impact that it will have on our management measures that your counterparts would have been more willing to be more aggressive in its dealings with how to better manage herring between our two nations, although I understand they've got the FRCC and they're obliged to use it, but still it's sort of like punting the ball to the FRCC, and we just wait until the report is out and decisions are made. So it's unfortunate. Thank you.
Yeah. She didn't actually indicate that she wouldn't or couldn't take unilateral action if she thought there was some concern or if DFO thought there was some concern with the herring resource. And we are meeting with them again next week. So I'll raise the issue again, express our concern again. But then the other thing is that we did have Canadian landings going back, I don't know how many years now, several years. And there were at least two other instances where they had gone over 30,000 metric tons, but had never sustained it for more than 1 year either. So it does seem to be some sort of cyclical availability of the resource to the weir fishery.
Pat, you know, we've discussed in the past that we wanted to bring herring under that a similar TMGC-type umbrella and we started by having herring on the track. So none of that has changed, that eventually we want to set up a system similar to what we have for cod, haddock, and yellowtail. Is that correct?
Well, actually, at the last two NRCC meetings, we revisited that before this situation with the weir fishery, and I think the decision at the NRCC was there didn't seem to be a lot of interest in pursuing transboundary discussions, that we had the track process, so we were set up to do it, but that we put it on the back burner at the NRCC discussions.
Well, that's something that the council ought to think about then, because if we follow normal practice, if if their catches are going up, we'd have to take them off the top of our catches. So that the council then would probably want to, you know, make some type of a statement that we do want to proceed in the TMGC realm so that we can negotiate our fair share rather than take it off the top.
Anyone else for Pat? Dave Gaethel.
Pat, I'm glad to hear that the Eliminator trawl will be approved shortly, and you mentioned it could be used in the B-Day program, but I believe it has a minimum, the net that was tested has a bigger rockhopper size than is allowed in the Western Gulf of Maine, which will, again, de facto put them out of the B-Day program again. So I was just wondering whether, well, two things. I would consult with the makers of the net because I don't think the rockhopper was the critical component in sorting the catch. They just built a large rockhopper because they were working some real rough ground on Georges. That would be first. But second of all, if you do decide to go with a minimum rockhopper size that exceeds what's allowed in the Western Gulf of Maine, that you grant people who use that net an exemption to fish there so that they can access the haddock on the B-Day program.
Of course, one of the most time-consuming things about moving forward with these kinds of things is figuring out the appropriate gear configuration. So we are going proposed rule, final rule, which will allow people the opportunity to see the proposal and provide that kind of input. So definitely what we're looking for once we get a proposal in the street.
Anyone else on the council? Okay. NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just bring you up to date on the lawsuits that we have active regarding the New England Council. In the Western Sea case, which is the case challenging the permit splitting provision in Herring Amendment 1, the plaintiffs have filed their motion for summary judgment. We have filed our and brief in support of that. We have filed our cross motion for summary judgment to dismiss the case and our brief in support of it. And the plaintiffs have filed a reply brief to our brief, and we have a reply brief due on Wednesday. Oral arguments for this case are set in Federal District Court in Boston on April 22nd, which is next week. In the Mid-Coast lawsuit, formerly the NAMA lawsuit, which challenged our denial of the petition for rulemaking to ban midwater trawl herring vessels from groundfish closed areas, that case, we are filing the administrative record in answer to that case on Wednesday. And then we'll set up, I'm sure, a briefing schedule with the court. In the Oceana case, which challenged the SBRM omnibus amendment, we are in the process of preparing the record and answer, which are going to be due probably in 30 days or so from now. There's been no movement or activity regarding the lawsuits brought by Massachusetts and New Hampshire challenging Framework 42 since our last meeting. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Gene? Okay. Northeast Fisheries Science Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Weinberg is not here. He's back at the lab. We have a variety of activities that are ongoing related to assessments, so he's not here. And, in fact, we've had some preliminary presentations on ecosystem impacts relative to the groundfish fishery, so he's been very much involved in those activities this week. So I'm here, obviously, giving the report. The first thing I'll mention is that the spring bottom trawl survey is ongoing, and that's an effort that includes the albatross and the Bigelow, and of course also includes the calibration of the Bigelow and the albatross. And so far we've completed over 130 usable paired toes as far as the calibration is concerned, And I think everybody's aware as well that we have Dr. Russ Brown, who's going to be here on Thursday, giving a more in-depth presentation on the Bigelow and the calibration with some preliminary results as well. The 2008 clam survey is going to be conducted on the Delaware II from June 30th to August 8th. This, again, should be the last year that we do the survey on the one of our fishery survey vessels, and we're transitioning to the industry-based surveys. And so those discussions with the industry regarding that movement to the industry-based surveys is going very well. The scallop survey is going to be conducted in two 18-day legs on the RV Hugh Sharp, which is the University of Delaware National Science Foundation, what we call the UNOLS vessel. And that's going to be in June and July. And we are actually having some internal discussions about moving the 2009 survey earlier in the year to achieve better integration of stock assessment data with management cycles. Pat mentioned the stock assessment schedule that we have. The next big SARC that we have is in June of 2008, and that's for summer flounder. We also have a series of updates that we're involved with, including bluefish, black sea bass scup, squid, mackerel, butterfish, dogfish, and herring. The GARM biological reference point meeting is going to be held the last week of April. And you've heard this a number of times, but the benchmark assessment meeting will be held the first week of August. In December of 2008, we've decided, and this was vetted through the NRCC, that we will not have a SARC per se. And this is when we're going to put our efforts into the data poor working group. And that list includes black sea bass, red crab, scup, skates, wolffish, and weakfish. We also, during that same time frame, at least in the fall, earlier than December, we're going to be hosting an ICES stock assessment methods meeting, and I think that's going to be extremely useful in terms of working with people and evaluating current techniques, new techniques, and will be very timely, I think, relative to the December meeting, because the ICES meeting is in October. The Data Poor Working Group will be meeting in December, and so I think this is really good timing. And then in June of 2009, we agreed to do Atlantic surf clam, tilefish, and weakfish. Much of our efforts during that time period are going to be devoted to evaluating the data from the vessel calibration experiment. And so those species, those stocks in particular, do not rely on the calibration results. So that is good timing relative to that. And then taking us through December of 2009, we have ocean quahog, hagfish, possibly, and a series of other data poor stocks, including hakes, the silver, red, and offshore. So that's where we are. And the schedule actually continues through 2011, but unless somebody really wants to hear what that is, I'll stop there. And this schedule is also available on our website. So if you go to the Northeast Center's website, there's a link to the SAWSARC, and it has that schedule in there, and it's updated regularly. The last thing I want to mention is related to the consultation process for the standardized bycatch reporting methodology and the prioritization process that is already started. And as in the SBRM, the councils in public are provided an opportunity to consider and provide input into the decisions regarding the prioritization of our ATSI observer coverage allocations. And so we've gone ahead and put a table together which summarizes the planned allocation of over 6,000 ATSI observer days for the calendar year in 2008. And these allocations reflect information that we have available through April, so it's very recent information. And what I'd like to do at this point is I provided this to council staff, and I'd like to go ahead and have it handed out to everybody. I hope there's enough copies. There might not. Oh, okay. So it's been handed out. And rather than get into any kind of discussion about this at this point, We plan to allow you to look at this, think about it, and then come back to us in June at the June Council meeting, and we will have an in-depth discussion about it. But know that there's at-sea coverage levels which are required to attain the SVRM performance in each of the applicable fisheries, and we have coverage levels available if available resources were allocated proportionally across all applicable fisheries. And then there's the real-world application in terms of the days at sea that we have that we consider discretionary. And if you take a real quick look at the table, you'll see that clearly there are days that are obligated to be allocated based on either legislated mandates or through earmarks that we get, which were resulted from previous litigation. And so when you look at the table, there's a total number of days, but some of those are obligated in terms of the allocations, for example, under ESA for sea turtles or under MMPA for marine mammals. So those come right off the top. So remember that when you're looking at this table in terms of what can be allocated. So again, what we'll do is we'll allow you to look at this and we'll have the opportunity to discuss it in greater detail in June. And that's what I have.
Questions for Nancy? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Nancy, you indicated that Jim is not here because he's, I guess, back in Woods Hole, involved in some presentation regarding ecosystem impacts relative to the groundfish fishery. Could you elaborate a little bit as to what that's all about?
It's an internal meeting, and as you know, we're including a term of reference now in all of our stock assessments that relate to ecosystems, and that is the interaction between ecosystems and the fisheries and productivity. We're at the point where we do have some data that we are looking at relative to thermal changes and some of the chemistry and things like that, and see if there are ways that we can provide linkages with fisheries productivity. So it is an internal meeting. It's not an, you know, for prime time kind of thing, but it's just us reviewing the information that we have in terms of Mike Fogarty and some of those folks who have been looking at that. It will be vetted, obviously, through the GARM process, so there will be that opportunity. But given that this is so important and there are so many people that are obviously waiting to find out what the answers are relative to this, we're taking our time, obviously, internally to make sure that when we do vet this through the GARM process, that what we're vetting is good information.
Thank you. That sounds like a very responsible approach to deal with a very important issue, as you indicated. 130 usable pair toes between the Bigelow and the Albatross. That's great news. Glad to hear that. That gives me some reason to be very optimistic. If you've made usable toes, that means, I think, that maybe all of the problems that you've had to face regarding the Albatross, well, the Bigelow, those problems have been ironed out, you know, the way the net fishes and the way the vessel performs. Am I correct that things seem to be going along rather swimmingly?
I would say that things are going along well, but in terms of the ultimate answer, whether things have gone along well, we obviously have to work through this calibration experiment. And it will continue through the middle of May. So, I mean, everything is operational. I can say that much. Things are working. But what that means in terms of the performance and the calibration, I don't know. And we won't know that, obviously, until we're done. But because we were asked to come and give a presentation relative to some previous work that we had done in the flume tank, we thought it might be a good opportunity to share at least some of the preliminary information as well. But again, it's preliminary, and so we won't really know until May. But, yeah, I mean, given the history of problems with the Bigelow, so far it seems to be good news.
Thank you. And finally, you referenced the standardized bycatch reporting methodology, and I draw your attention to table number one in the document that was just distributed to us, and I just need to make sure I'm interpreting this correctly. I go to table one, I go down to fishing mode 19 and 20, the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic midwater trawl fishery, I go across and I see that you have prioritized 2008 coverage, 111 trips for the New England Midwater Trawl and 103 trips for the Mid-Atlantic Midwater Trawl fishery. Am I correct that those are the scheduled numbers of trips for those two fisheries?
Yes, yes, yes. That's what that means.
Anything else for Nancy? Any other questions? Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I've just got a glance at a copy of the document for the SPRM. Is there going to be supporting information to go along with this as far as analysis or the background information? Is that going to be available either to the council or to the public?
Well, much of it is already available in the SBRM in terms of the process that's used to establish the priorities. But yeah, we will provide additional information particularly relative to what I was talking about in terms of those days that are obligated. There will be further documentation.
Okay. And is this the official announcement that there are insufficient resources? Is this serving as that that stage in the SBRM process? I guess this is a question for the regional office.
Oh. Yeah, I couldn't understand your question, so Pat was repeating it in my ear. Yeah, I think that's pretty apparent. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I just figured that there's a trigger built in there. So.
Yeah.
Thanks
yeah.
very much. We've got a lot more questions, but as it gets towards June, we'll address those. Thanks very much.
Anyone else? Okay, moving on to Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Liaisons.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-Atlantic Council met in Annapolis April 7th to the 10th. They voted to recommend Alternative 1 for Framework 6 to the Monkfish Plan to eliminate the target TAC overage backstop measures. Their SSC met on day one of the meeting. I wasn't there for that, but either I believe you were there for that, or Jim might want to fill us in what happened there. The bycatch committee is working on an informational handout on the benefits of using circle hooks. They're proceeding on that. The fluke amendment, they're still working on, very similar to one of ours, or they might be challenging us. They've been working on it for about 5 years, and doesn't seem to be any clear goals and objectives. But they do have, will be considering summer flounder commercial allocation, scup commercial allocation, management of summer flounder, party and charter boat fishery, scup and black sea bass, the management of summer flounder in the recreational fishery, and also the management of scup in the recreational fishery. It is not dealing with the black sea bass recreational. And also, finally, they'll be looking at the limitation on vessel replacement and upgrades, and that has to do with, I believe it's the black sea bass fishery. And they had some concerns there. They're looking to change the vessel upgrade restrictions, or to, more like to do away with them, I think. The tilefish amendment was voted and approved for submission, and that was for basically ITQs. And also, and that was basically about it. I think Jim can fill in a little more, John, on the first day. But I'll also say something that was unique. It was the first time I've seen a motion go through that was debated, and it was defeated, didn't have a single yes vote. So I think that was a new first. But that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Jim, did you have anything to add?
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the SSC committee meeting on Monday, there was a lot of discussion. Some of the concerns the SSC has got with being brought into this, it was apparent early on that there was quite a workload here was going to be presented to these people with absolutely no pay. We've already talked about this before, but the one of the big issues here is the fact that this council meets two different times a year to deal with a number of species. You got June meeting for specs, which is squid, mackerel, butterfish, ocean quahogs, clams, and tilefish. And then the August meeting is fluke, scup, sea bass, summer flounder, and bluefish. The concern by the SSC was how they were going to get this information in a timely manner in order to make these kind of to participate in a helpful forum and try to provide their expertise. There's quite a bit of concern on that, and of course there were some motions made to try to front load things as much as possible, but the timing that is required for the Science Center to release some of its information seemed to be part of the discussion. But there's a lot of uncertainties at this point, Mr. Chairman, as to how the SSC is going to be able to do what it's being charged to do in a timely manner, and how, in fact, that's going to roll into the monitoring committee that we use now, which is basically the PDT equivalent of your PDT, whether that will be ongoing or will it actually evolve into the SSC taking that position. That's going to be an interesting transition as it takes place. But in the meantime, it was suggested that the SSC members that could would participate in the upcoming meetings for spec setting and utilize the monitoring committee just to witness the process to make the determination. But there's some major concerns with the workload and the timing of the receiving the data, Mr. Chairman.
I had a question, Jim, or maybe Frank. I wasn't there for the tilefish discussion, but I hear right that you guys submitted an amendment, an ITQ amendment?
Yeah. That was, in fact, submitted, and it was heavily favored by the majority of the council members. There's some issues, and I'm on the other side of this, Mr. Chairman. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I am very dissatisfied with the way it went down, but it's a personal issue. I got no stake in the game, but I'd like to talk to you about that off the record. But, in fact, it did go through, and I think there's going to be there's a lot of concerns by a lot of different entities, both industry members and actually some environmental groups, about some of the issues that kind of got rolled into it related to HAPC and habitat. But I'm not the right one to talk to about this, and I lost all the way around on this.
So the council approved to submit a new amendment that has an ITQ. Did you guys have to go through a referendum? That's right. Mid-Atlantic doesn't have that. Okay. How long was that plan under development?
I believe it's 5 years.
5 years.
I think we're 5 years now. It doesn't even come close to our champion for delays, which is Amendment 9 to Squid Mackerel Butterfish, which is celebrating its 8th birthday. I think it's 5 years is where we are on tilefish, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
And to that point, should state that there's way less than 100 votes involved in this. It's developed in tiers. And the tiered allocations that are actually the fishery is under involves four votes in the top tier. There's way less than 100 players here, and it was 5 years to develop, and it certainly was controversial, to say the least.
Okay, we can talk later about that. Terry Stockholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have missed it, but a question to Frank or Jim about the status of the development of the new Quahog Amendment.
I'm trying to think of where we were. That amendment's going forward. That I don't know if it's been submitted yet. Pat may remember that. I don't believe it has been submitted, but it's ongoing. There were some issues related to the VMS which have been resolved. The excessive shares, that's what it was. There was quite a bit of discussion on excessive shares related to both of those plans. And there's some internal review going on. There's really not a clear definition from the agency on excessive shares. Magnuson speaks of it, but it doesn't provide any real good information to make a determination on. And as a matter of fact, excessive shares came up in this tilefish debate, but there's a big difference in what the administration and the agency considers excessive shares. That's so much more related to market issues than it is actually fishing opportunities. And I think us in the industry look at it the other way. An excessive share could, in fact, be a high percentage of allocation to catch fish. So there's quite a bit of discussion that's going to have to take place there, and I advise you to keep that one on your radar screen.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Excessive shares was even filtered its way up into the northern Maine discussion. We have, as you know, we have the mahogany quahog fishery, and we have some. We'll be monitoring that. I'd like to keep in touch with you about that.
Anything else on Mid-Atlantic issues? Okay. United States Coast Guard.
Good morning. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. We have a few pictures to go with this thing coming up here. Here we go. And you all have a few color slides that got delivered to you this morning. There's two pictures there. Right? We'll talk about the first one, which is the one on the left, and that's a Coast Guard team going up on board a commercial oil carrier, product tanker in this case. Doesn't look like it has much to do with fisheries, but I just wanted to invite your attention to some of the other missions we're doing. As you know, we board and look for compliance with all applicable regs on the oil industry, too. And recently we've had two great court cases here get settled out, one with Overseas Shipping and one with Ionia Ship Management. It's $37 million in one case and $12 million in fines in the other case. And they're both for the same thing, which is having a corporate culture of dumping oil at sea. All right. Two of these guys, well, one was habitually dumping in the Gulf of Maine, and another one was habitually dumping in the approaches to New York, out where you fish and out where we're trying to keep a healthy environment for fish stocks to grow. So although it doesn't look like it's related to fishing, believe me, it is. It's all ocean governance, and we've been having some great successes there, and I thought I'd just bring those two cases to your attention. The other small picture there on the right is the that's the Lady Sonia up off of Gloucester. Cowboy up is a good thing. Keel up, not such a good thing. That's a little Coast Guard 25-foot response boat next to an overturned fishing boat from about a month ago. Luckily, there were two people on board, and they were kind enough to sink within 3 miles of a Coast Guard station. We got right out there to them and recovered both of those folks. So there was no injury in that case. But we continue to see boats, eight fishing vessels since I've talked to you the last time have sunk. Three at sea, five at the dock. So material conditions, stability, these are things that continue to be on our minds and concern us. Into enforcement, we get on to 287, so almost 300 fishing boats in this period. 18 violations. We would have expected to see 9 violations if we were staying within norms. So although we don't have a great raw number of violations that we're observing, we have twice as many as we would expect in this last period. We haven't really gotten down into the numbers to know what that means. And again, the raw numbers themselves are not that big. But another way to look at it is we're seeing compliance problems at twice the normal rate, something both the Coast Guard and NOAA is talking about. And we're going to work together to try and get a grip on and see what's going on out there. Safety, 30 perps we responded to. Most were false alarms. Lives saved. Thankfully, there were no lives lost during this period, so that's a great thing. Let's take a look at this case here. This is the Captain Joe, which sank down off of New Jersey. And it illustrates two things. I think, one, this is a SAR case that started out kind of bad because the mayday call we got from the Captain Joe was not as helpful as it could have been. For instance, they didn't tell us where they were, and they didn't tell us what the nature of their trouble was. It was just a mayday call from the Captain Joe. A little later on, we get into, I think, we're off the coast of New Jersey, which is helpful, but I think you would want to tell us a little more if you were in the drink. There's kind of three lines that go out to it, and that's from our new radio system called Rescue 21 that's deployed off the coast right now of New York and New Jersey. And three different sites that we broadcast and receive from, and in this case, we heard that mayday on three different antenna sites. That allowed us to take a DF bearing, which, if you remember in the old days, would sort of pin you in the North Atlantic. But with some of the new digital technology that we've got, we were able to pin it within just about a mile of where it actually came from. And that's how the helicopter got out. They had a great commence search point that was within, I think, just 2 miles of where they were, which if you can get the pilot to within 2 miles and he's got visibility, he's going to fly straight to you. He's going to see you. And that's what happened in this case. That technology doesn't exist everywhere yet. It's on the coast of New York and New Jersey. and it's going to come up through Connecticut and southeastern New England and up into Maine within the next 2 years. So 2008, 2009, 2010, we'll have that great coverage all the way up. So some good news with the Cat and Joe there. That's a VMS position. It was also really useful to us in prosecuting this case. But again, I want to stress, e-perbs and radio calls are what tip the Coast Guard off that you're in trouble, not VMS. VMS is one of the sort of forensic tools. It's one of the first places we'll go when we know you're in trouble. And in this case, it was very helpful because we had a very recent VMS hit from it. So VMS is useful to us in the search and rescue business, but VMS is not a search and rescue notification tool. Okay? Next slide. That just sort of shows the light blue area down off Connecticut and New Jersey and New York is where this new Rescue 21 system is. And the darker blue areas up to the north show you how that will roll out through 2009. Now, do we really think it's going to happen in 2009? That's what the contract is. But let's say 2010, and then we know it'll really happen by then. Right? But we should be having this this great new benefit out there. Also, as many of you know, there's a lot of VHF holes out there where you used to be able to talk or call us and we couldn't hear you. And Rescue 21, pretty much to about 70 to 90 miles off the coast, is going to have complete coverage. So it's a great increase in our safety communication system. TWIX. It can't be a government system without an acronym, so the acronym for this is TWIC. Transportation Worker Identification Card. I took some questions from folks over the last month about what is TWIC and does it apply to fishermen? Am I going to have to get it if I'm a fisherman? A TWIC is, it looks remarkably like a military ID card, right? And TWICs are required by the new Maritime Transportation Security Act. And they're for people in the transportation business and people in the maritime transportation business. So who needs to have a TWIC? Do fishermen need to have a TWIC? Maybe. But if they need to have a TWIC, it's not because they're fishermen. It's because of some other reason. So folks that need to have them are Coast Guard credentialed merchant mariners. So if you have a Z card or you have an able-bodied seaman or you've got a license and you happen to be a fisherman, you have to get a TWIC, not because you're a fisherman, but because you're a Coast Guard credentialed mariner. Port facility employees. If you fish on the weekends or you fish your days at sea, but you happen to work at the container terminal or an oil offloading facility, you're going to have to get a TWIC, but not because you're a fisherman, because of what you do on your days off. Similarly, longshoremen truck drivers that are working inside of anybody who's hauling containers is going to have a TWIC, and a couple other categories of folks there. So you might be a fisherman, and you might need to have a TWIC, but it won't be because you're a fisherman. Does that make sense? Hope so. If you have any individual questions about TWICs, please get them to me, and I'll see if I can get you a customized answer to your situation. All right? Next slide. Remember this one from last council when Admiral Sullivan was up presenting? Work remains on the common thread of these two losses, Lady of Grace and Lady Luck. And at the last presentation, we said government, industry, and fishermen should resolve the impasse over stability issues such that every fishing vessel master will know the safe operating limits for his vessel, know when he's standing into danger, know how to act decisively to correct stability problems, and bring every boat and crew home safely. Whether or not stability regs for smaller vessels get passed, responsible owners and operators should know their conditions and limits now. Toward this end, the Coast Guard has put out in the Federal Register on March 31st, you got this handout too, stability regulations for vessels between 50 and 79 feet. All right. Along with stability regulations is also some proposed regulations for training. We want to extend the places that you have to have survival suits, and there's a couple other interesting things in there. If you go to the next slide, it sort of lists out what they are. You can read that probably as well as I can, huh? Vessel stability calculations, required vessel stability training, okay, crew preparedness, EPIRB registration. We continue to get that all the time. We'll have an EPIRB go off in the Gulf of Maine, and it'll be unregistered. Boy, you just, it's about 30 minutes that you're going to front end on the beginning of that SAR case before we can figure out whose EPIRB it is. Is the boat at sea? Is it a real case? Is it not a real case? Whatever. If you have an EPIRB, please register it. New survival craft requirements, high water alarm requirements, right, bilge alarms, separation and marking of outdated and excessive safety gear. So if you have a survival suit that you want to use for training, but it's got holes in it, or you have some old pyro and you want to keep it to shoot it off and do some exercise with it sometime, but it's expired, you want to keep it on the boat, we think you ought to be able to. We just want it segregated from where the emergency supplies are. So if there's a hole in that training suit, like there often is, or the zipper's not that good, that's not the suit you grab when the chips are down. We want to have those two separated. We do it on our ships. We think it's a great practice. Next one is, what? That's the end of the slide. Yeah, documentation of stability training. We've got to figure out how we're going to do that. And at the end of it, this is 8 pages of the Federal Register. That's a pretty fun read. So if anybody's having trouble getting to sleep at night, I'd recommend this document. But if you look at the end of it, there's about 30 questions that we're looking for your input on. We don't pretend to know exactly what we're going to do with stability regs. We're starting the process. We're looking for your help, your thoughts, your input on how to make boats safer, particularly for the next generation of boats that we hope to be able to build soon here, huh, when fishing gets better. The time to get these stability regs in is now before we can recapitalize the fleet. It also says we don't mean to limit your input to those 30 questions. They're just sort of 30 questions to get a conversation going. So if there's something else you're thinking about with stability or something else with safety, please get it into this process, and let's see if we can make this a safer world. We lost 6 guys. Let's not lose 6 more before we get some regs in place. That's all the presentation I had, so if anybody's got a question, I'll try and answer them.
Any questions? Rodney, then Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Captain McGinnis. That was very good. We've been, as you know, I'm doing this on a daily basis now, so we've been segregating all suits that are used for training, marking them, and also marking bags differently so they know. Different locker, different bags. We put a tag on them just for training purposes only, and we put that on a suit also. The other thing we do is we take the air bladder off them, because they're just used on deck to put them on. No one enters the water with them. So we have been doing that. So that's a good thing. And on the vessel stability thing, I think what we need to do is distinguish vessel stability from vessel comfort. Because a lot of fishermen are thinking, well, I put outriggers on my boat, it makes it stable. And it makes it more comfortable, but not necessarily more stable. So I think maybe on one of those questions should identify that.
Rodney gets to the heart of a very important matter. And that's often there are vessels now that have stability letters and have had stability calculations done. But often what we find in boarding or interviewing the master who's operating the boat on any given day, he doesn't use a stability book. And if you got the stability book out and you gave him a quiz on its contents or how to use its contents, some of them would know, some of them wouldn't know. The concepts of stability it's not common sense. It's something that you got to go get some training on and think your way through some of these situations before you really begin to understand how a boat operates, what's good for a boat, what's not. And Rodney's made a very crucial distinction. There's a difference between a boat that rides good and a stable boat. A stable boat's snappy. It's not that comfortable. It comes up quick. A boat that rides good, a good seakeeping boat, probably has less reserve stability than a boat that's snappy. Okay? Lots of people, you know, they're in love with these paravanes. It's something that started in the Gulf Coast because people used to tow off them, and now they bring it up here to the Northeast, and we're running paravanes and birds for comfort. Well, I don't think you'll find a naval architect anywhere that would advise you that that's a good idea. In fact, the reason they make your boat more comfortable is they work against the reserve buoyancy in the righting arm of the vessel. They work against it. It doesn't matter when it's only blowing 25, but when it's blowing 50, it starts to matter. Your boat leans over and it wants to snap back up. And that paravane that dug down, the bird that dug down, is keeping it from snapping up. That's not common sense. But after you think through it and get a little training, you go, wow, what am I doing with rigors on it? Take it to the extreme. Now you're in a full, you've gone through the gale, you're into a full storm. What can you do with those birds? You pull them up out of the water? Can you pull your poles up? Yeah. You're screwed. That's the deal with those. Yeah. 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 There's some great, if you've got them on and you've got some immediate concerns about them, Transport Canada's got some great articles out on them. And they're very, very PC, and they just say in a very nice way, if you insist on having these on your boat, there's some things you ought to think about. And it walks you through each one of those scenarios. So there's a difference, right, between stability and good riding boats. And we just don't see overall a great academic understanding of stability within the industry. We'd like to do some training so people understand not only things like poles, but what do you do with cross connects? You know, how, do you keep fuel tanks full or empty? What do you do with water tanks? Does it matter if you're using your batter boards down in the hold? Yeah, it matters a lot. You know, some boats we see things very segregated, but in other boats we see it just, ice is just dumped in a hold. So anyway, we think there's a lot that can be done with just some plain old training and stability.
Jim Adler?
Yes, and I noticed on your vessel stability calculations, you're talking about affecting 50 to 79 foot boats. Are you envisioning that being new built, or are you going to go back and try, when you implemented the 79 and up, it was, I think, boats built after 1997 or something. Is this going to have the same type of thing, boats built after 2007 or something like that?
I think
that?
It's really important that we hear from you on that. I don't think we've decided. I don't think the service has decided, are we going to apply it to new builds? Yeah, definitely to new builds. But would we apply it to boats that are substantially altered as currently exists, and then how do you define a substantial alteration? But if you have opinions on that, I would love for you to put them on paper and send them
in. I'll send something. And are you still going to use Canadian steamship calculations? Is that the standard you're going to use in the stability?
I don't know, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to just make sure I'm clear on this TWIC thing. I think it's an awful acronym. It sounds a feat. You know, here's my TWIC. If I have a 100-ton license, I hadn't thought of it this way until you mentioned it. If I have a 100-ton license and I'm working on a fishing boat but not using that license in a passenger-carrying capacity, then I still have to have the TWIC?
Yeah, if you have a license, you have to have a TWIC.
Even if you're just on the boat, you have a license?
Yeah, if you have a license. If you have a license and you're not even working on a boat,
you still have a license
and you're working in an office, you have to get a TWIC.
Okay. Can you turn the license in so you don't have to bother with that? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think it's about $100, I want to say, to go through the whole process. If you have to get a TWIC, you're supposed to have it by August of this year. Okay. It's pretty easy to get one. I got to go through it too. It's pretty easy to get one now. I bet by August it'll be all gummed up because everybody's going to roll the dice and wait till the end.
Paul Howard.
It's a new ID, all subject to background check and finger.
A background. It's a very basic background check. Yeah. So this is not the Coast Guard. This is TSA that does this, folks. Okay. And it's a basic criminal background check that they're doing. Now, think about it. You can bring a container in on a container ship, and it can be in the middle of our country in about, 48 hours. Okay? So TSA thinks we need to know a little bit about who's operating these terminals and who's driving these trucks.
Dave Gaethel.
Yes, Joe, I never heard of this till today. Are they going to notify people that they need this? I mean, I just renewed my license in November, and nobody said a word about it then. So I'm kind of wondering how many other people don't even know it exists.
That's kind of depressing, Dave, to hear that. I know now I was down at the wreck last week, and they've got posters everywhere. And they've been talking to it for close to 2 years. But whether or not credentialed merchant mariners are going to get a letter, I don't know. But it's kind of depressing that you don't know about it. I mean, we haven't told you somehow.
Well, I mean, my suggestion would be that perhaps they might want to do a mailing or release some publications in the press or something. I mean, like I said, I was in WREC in Boston. I was right around my birthday, around November 14th last year. And there were no signs up. There was nothing about TWIC. And I sat there, a fair amount of time while they processed my paperwork. So I pretty much read everything on the walls just for something to do.
Yeah.
I got a son in the transportation business. I think there's probably most of the people sitting at this table have licenses.
Right.
I don't know how many other people have heard of it, but I try to keep up on things, and I haven't heard a peep.
Yeah. On behalf of TSA, we'll see if we can do a better job of working with them to make sure the word's getting out to everybody. Okay. Now, the good news is they're opening up a lot of local offices to do this. So if you have a license, you're not going to have to go to Commercial Street in Boston to get this done. You'll be able to go to a TSA office in Bourne. There's one out on the Cape. There's one in Portsmouth, I think. There's one in Portland, and there's, I think, even one further down east than that. So it should be a lot more convenient than coming into an REC to get your license renewed.
TSA, those are the people that make us take our shoes off to get on an airplane?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Frank, and then Jim Rule.
Yeah, I know it's taking a little more time, but yeah, there's also an office here in Providence. It's $130. It's good for 5 years. Unless you haven't get it for 5 years, I think it's around $100, and it's good until it depends on when your license is. So the goal is to have it that it's renewable at the same time as your license. You show up with your passport or different identification, the fingerprint and all that, and then it takes probably 6 to 8 weeks because I've been waiting for mine for a while now, but I get moving on it.
Jim Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While I don't like to inflict the pain of attending a council meeting on family members, I really wish my sons were here to hear your last statement, because I've been 35 years telling them no sissy sticks are going on that boat, because she always comes back. She might come back a little quicker than you want her to, but when you got a 200,000 capacity of fish hole and you use 25, 30 tons of seawater, you want something to come back quick. I really would have liked them to hear it from an expert rather than just the old man who don't know his asthma tin cup. But one thing I did want to say on this, I got to give the Coast Guard a lot of credit on this safety issue. A lot of it has to do with Admiral Potosky, who was actually in this area for a long time and ended up with an excellent working relationship with the industry.
Great.
My wife sits on that CIVAC committee and has for 10 years. They're meeting in May of this year, and they met in Seattle last year. And it was presented to us then that they had actually withdrawn going forward with this because of a lot of the concerns that the industry had. Any other time, it would have been done. I mean, the big issue that tripped it up was the ABS specifications. You know, the qualifications that were being suggested for stability were to meet existing ABS, American Bureau of Steamship, and it just wasn't possible. But recognizing that, and some of the concerns related to stability on different size vessels prompted the Admiral to hold it up. And I think with the product that they've got now is much better.
Great.
There's opportunities in there for grandfathering vessels that have not had significant modifications. And that's the concern people have. And, you know, if you are experienced with a specific vessel, either David or myself or Frank Blount, we know when the boat starts to feel wrong. But what about your transit captains and crews? That's what you've got to be concerned with. They don't know what the boat's supposed to feel like. They don't know when something is wrong. So there's plenty of opportunities for not only comments, but the industry input in what will result in a better product. And I do have to give the Coast Guard a lot of credit for holding up on this one, because if they rushed into it, it would have been extremely costly. No way to actually implement the required surveys and inspections that were going to be necessary. The infrastructure is not there. So, in all fairness, they did a great job. And lastly, just to make the council aware, you all know that Rodney's been deeply involved with safety ever since he's been in fishing, and he's doing an excellent job. And National Fishermen rewarded him this year with a 2008 Highliner Award, and it's well deserved for a man that's done a tremendous amount for our industry. Thank you.
Rodney.
Anything else for Joe?
All set. Thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, just a comment, and I've mentioned this several times, and I was just reading in your Federal Register your report on age of vessels, and it's quite obvious that the older the boats, which is what we have mostly in the fleet, are 66% of them in the steel hulls. 66% of your accidents happening on boats of 20 to 40 years old, 75% on fiberglass boats. So, we need to be thinking about how do we get the industry to a level that they can afford to replace vessels, because the fleet is old.
Okay, anything else? NIMS enforcement. Andy? Are you going to have Bill join you, or do you want us? All right, Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. Rodney, congratulations. It's an honor to work with you. Rodney's going to be giving an enforcement committee report tomorrow, and he's been the driving force behind all the accomplishments we've made in that committee. So I salute you, my friend. I want to tell you about three unusual cases today that I think you'll be interested in. I gave you a Department of Justice press release on a fellow named Steve Kudo, who I've told you about before when he was I think I told you about it when he was indicted, and then I told you about it when he pleaded guilty. He was sentenced to a year and a day in federal prison. What he did was he structured cash payments to pay cash for overages in New Bedford, and he got caught up in pretty much the same scam that governor of New York got caught up in making cash withdrawals of about $10,000. Actually, they were a little bit less than $10,000, and the IRS requires a currency transaction report anytime you withdraw $10,000. So if you go and buy a car and you want to pay cash, you've got to fill out this little currency transaction report. It's not illegal to do that, to take out that much money. It was originally that law was originally created to discourage money laundering involved in the drug trade. So it's not illegal to do that, but it's illegal not to do the currency transaction report. And in Kudo's case, he didn't take out $10,000. He took out like $9,999 over and over again, and that's called structuring. And structuring is a violation of the CTR requirements, just as if you didn't file a report. And there were some substantial overages that he bought over the course of a couple of years. So he was sentenced to a year and a day, and just as an aside, the reason it was a year and a day, the judge kind of threw the defendant a bone. In the federal justice system, there is very limited time given for good behavior. It's when you're in prison. If you are sentenced to less than a year, you're not eligible for any time credit. If you're sentenced to more than a year, you can get up to 2 months off your sentence for good behavior. So by giving him a year and a day, Mr. Kudo will be maybe eligible for release in 10 months. So that's the reason for the odd kind of a sentence. The second case I want to brief you on is one that I've talked about a couple of times in the past. It's part of the Virginia Star et al. Cases, which involve the illegal importation of Vietnamese catfish laundered through Laos to avoid anti-dumping taxes and treated with malachite green. Some of it was treated with malachite green, which is a carcinogen that is used in some countries as an antifungal in aquaculture products. Although I would be remiss in not stating that they were not charged with that adulteration with the carcinogen. However, it did occur. True World Foods, which is a company in Chicago, is one of 26 defendants charged in that case, and they were sentenced a couple of weeks ago, and they've got to pay $60,000 in fine money, and they forfeited more than almost $198,000 in the value of the fish that was seized. A second of the 26 defendants, David Wong, who was associated with True World Foods, pleaded guilty, and he has not yet been sentenced, but he faces up to 2 years in jail and a fine of up to $100,000. The remaining 24 or 23 defendants are now scheduled to go to trial in Virginia in mid-October. And it's anybody's guess whether or not that trial will actually take place or if they will plead guilty prior to that. But we are getting ready for trial, and it's going to be a major trial. It's going to take a lot of preparation and effort. But I think the case is a very strong one, and it's a very important one because of the concern that we have that increased aquaculture is going to increase fraud in the seafood industry. And I think that you folks, as the council, really have to keep a close eye on this, even though it's not your direct mandate. Because the fishing industry may be altered substantially by increased aquaculture, and what concerns us in law enforcement is not the increased aquaculture necessarily, but the potential for fraud. It's a wide open career for criminals. This is an up and coming crime. It's wide open, and there are people who are going to exploit that. I was really pleased earlier this month. I was invited to speak at the Boston Seafood Show on fraud in the seafood industry, which is kind of unprecedented because we in law enforcement have always kind of been skulking in the background at these kind of events, and it's been rare that we've been recognized or certainly invited to speak. So I did. I took the invitation and I spoke at the seafood show, and it was a pretty good turnout. I was kind of surprised at the number of people in industry who were interested, and they were not all marketers of seafood or people in production. There were a lot of people in the audience from the fishing industry, which told me that folks in the industry are recognizing that this is going to be a new challenge, and they think it is as serious as we do, and they're paying attention. I think you're all familiar with a document called the Precepts for Effective Fisheries Regulations that we published along with Coast Guard in its last iteration, and it's a guide for fisheries management councils. Precepts to develop regulations that are enforceable. We are now working on a sister document, the same thing, but it's aimed at the aquaculture industry and its guidance for developing aquaculture regulations that are enforceable, and it mostly centers upon traceability. And I think the traceability is not unique to a unique need to aquaculture products, but it's a good thing for wild caught fish, and it's a good thing for the industry. It leads to accountability, and I think it's going to preserve market values and promote honest fishermen and honest practices. So you'll be seeing that document in the future, and I encourage you to give me feedback if you think of things that we haven't included, because we're neophytes to this new challenge also. And if we put our heads together, maybe we can get out in front of it before it becomes a crisis. In your enforcement report, there is a brief mention on the first page of a $20,000 settlement for imposed on an HMS charter operator for interference. And this took place, this incident took place in Delaware. It was an assault on a Delaware state officer working under our joint enforcement agreement program as a federal officer. He was assaulted at the dock during the boarding, and we would resolve that with a $20,000 penalty, in addition to a state charge that I think may still be pending. He pleaded guilty. Anyway, we take that kind of thing quite seriously, and fortunately, nobody was injured during that incident. That concludes my portion. I'm going to hand it over to Bill Semro, who's going to talk about VMS developments. And, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to take questions now or later?
Anyone have a question? Jim Allen.
Yeah, on the, I guess it's Fudo case, that appears to me, if you took it a dollar a pound, that's like 1.3 million pounds of overages. Were there any vessels prosecuted in this case for bringing in overages?
That's a good question, Jim, and I'm embarrassed that I don't know the answer, but I will find out and let you know.
Terry Stockwell and Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, there are a lot of rumors circulating around the general category fleet, particularly in the state of Maine, about the Chris Byers case. Are you able to provide any update on that?
I'm not, Terry. I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, Andy, on page 4 of the report, about a third of the way down, it says NOAA OLE special agents investigated several vessel owners allegedly suspected of submitting false reports to the Observer program. I don't know what – could you tell us a little bit about that? What, you know, I'm not really aware of any reports that have to be submitted to the Observer program.
Dave, I don't know the particulars about that. I know that we're working several observer-related cases, and that has been a priority with us and will continue to be a priority with us. We've developed a really good working relationship with the Observer program, which hasn't historically been the case. But as you know, we now have a special agent assigned to the Observer program and paid for by the Observer program. And, you know, those kind of personal relationships have all but eliminated the headbutting that used to go on between observers and enforcement. We're working with them as partners now, and it's working very well. I don't know the particulars of that item, but I can find out, and I'll give you a call.
Okay, I'd appreciate it. I'd just like to know if it's something like people, you know, giving a false sailing time, you know, saying, telling an observer I'll leave at 4 and then they leave at 2 or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know specifically.
Yeah, I'd just like to know what it is so I could.
Most of our observer-related cases have been involve observer refusals and harassment. Yeah. That being said, although it's a priority, I must add, it is not a problem of epidemic proportions. I think we're doing pretty well.
Anything else for Andy?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council members. I'm Bill Semro, the VMS Program Manager, Office of Enforcement in Gloucester. The VMS team is currently monitoring 1,500 vessels by vendor. It's 739 SkyMates, 724 boat tracks, and 37 Tron and Tron. Two vendors have expressed an interest in gaining Northeast approval of their VMS units. One is Faria, a company out of Uncasville, Connecticut, and the other is CLS America out of Largo, Maryland. Faria has already gained NIMS headquarters OLE approval in other regions, but has yet to be approved in the Northeast. Faria's data delivery format is email, which, in my experience, has been problematic for the timely delivery of declarations and position reports, affecting our trip generation and days at sea programs. Faria is working with NIMS headquarters OLE to change the delivery format to an IP gateway. This work is being done simultaneously with the stand-up of a new headquarters data center that will connect to all regions and allow us to decommission our local VMS servers. Once that work is completed and the Northeast VMS program is connected to both the data center and the gateway, I intend to resume Faria testing. CLS America has Argos VMS units deployed in the field in Alaska and the Northwest. They have just submitted a type approval request to NIMS headquarters for their new enhanced VMS unit called Helios. I met with CLS reps last week, received a VMS demo of their new unit, which uses the Iridium satellite constellation. I anticipate testing the unit later this summer in order to make a recommendation to the regional administrator. NIMS headquarters OLE recently published revised VMS standards. They were published on January 31st in the Federal Register. All current VMS vendors and those vendors seeking future approval must meet the new requirements. Previously installed VMS units will continue to be approved for the remainder of their service life. However, new installations must meet the new requirements. An example of some of the new requirements include a latency standard requiring receipt of declarations and position reports within 15 minutes of the time that they're sent, 97% of the time. Excuse me. The ability to store 100 position fixes in local memory, the ability to send specialized position reports for unique events such as antenna dislocation or loss of positioning reference, an address book feature, disabling any input or output device that could allow unauthorized software modifications, and prohibition of the transmission of data by SMTP or email to OLE. Some of the vendors will not meet all the new standards and are developing new VMS units. OLE is looking at options available to assist industry in meeting the new standards when their VMS unit fails. The reimbursement program is one such option being considered. Scallop Amendment 11 will require an operational VMS unit for all three new permit categories, IFQ, Northern Gulf of Maine, and Incidental Catch. Additionally, the amendment is driving the next VMS software rollout planned for June 1st. The software change includes a new Northern Gulf of Maine access area declaration for limited access general category permitted trips, the removal of the Hudson Canyon access area declaration from limited access general category, limited access and research set-aside trips, and finally, a new limited access general category scallop pre-landing notification form. I plan to have the new software tested and in the hands of industry when the amendment is implemented. The current target date is June 1. Amendment 11 was approved for the reimbursement program. Owners who do not currently have an installed VMS unit who purchase a VMS to comply with the new permit requirements of Amendment 11 may be eligible for reimbursement. I expect the program details to be explained in a permit holder letter following publication of the final rule. As of May 1st, the VMS requirement becomes a condition of permit for the surf clam ocean quahog fishery. Since January, VMS has been a condition of fishing in that fishery. The Northeast Permits Office will not issue a 2008 permit unless a surf clam ocean quahog vessel is determined to be VMS compliant. A new VMS program question and answer document was developed in February by the regional office with input from OLE. The reference can be found at the VMS webpage by going to the NERO website and clicking on the fishing industry homepage. The VMS user instructions for industry have been revised. The most recent version is dated April 10th. They're posted to the VMS webpage. Recent additions include a change to the trip notification email format, information on the effects of trip stitching in our monitoring system, and the requirement to declare a trip from port. I encourage all VMS users to refer to the instructions and call the VMS team if you have any questions. And finally, the regional office sent a permit holder letter on March the 12th, reminding industry of the requirement to make their VMS activity declaration prior to leaving port. This policy affects those who had been declaring a DOF, or Declare Out of Fishery Code, from their home port, sail closer to the fishing ground to save days at sea, and then enter inside the VMS demarcation line to declare a fishing code. While that practice of transiting under a DOF code with no fishing activity may continue, vessels intending to take a fishing trip must enter a port to declare the proper fishing code. Additionally, first-time offenders who are miscoded, that is, their VMS declaration doesn't match the area fished, will no longer be returned inside the demarcation line to redeclare. Rather, they will be instructed to return to a port to redeclare. Anybody that has a question regarding how specific ports are defined should refer those questions to the local NIMS enforcement office. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Questions for Bill? Jim Rohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, we got a concern that I was going to speak to you about later, but I probably need to put this on the record, as a matter of fact, regarding the requirements of vessels that hold certain limited access permits and are required to declare out of a fishery. The way that works, as soon as you cross the demarcation line on your way back in, you would automatically be notified that you ended a trip. This is a personal experience I had being involved with some cooperative research projects that involve crossing the demarcation line up to 10 times a day. It becomes impossible to, with everything else going on, to respond to that. We need to create some form of a registry or exemption program for vessels that, call in and notify you that's their intent, and they can provide documentation. They are, in fact, on a cooperative scientific fisheries research project with either any kind of whatever entity, whether it be on the Northeast Science Center Cooperative Research or Mid-Atlantic's Cooperative Research. I, in fact, notified Linda of our intention last year with our herring permit, and it got lost in the shuffle. So we didn't end up with any documentation on your end that, in fact, the call was made. So I would just suggest that you come up with a way that vessels that are in this situation have a backup, whatever requirements are necessary. We certainly will be able to meet them, but relieve us of the burden of this back and forth across it, and an understanding that the vessels are involved in such research, as we hope that this will expand in the future. Thank you.
Jim, was the vessel under an EFP or an LOA? Do you know?
Well, we were under a contract for ASMFC, National Marine Fisheries, and we had state permits for every state's waters that we were off of, but what was the permit, Chris? LOA. It was an LOA. So, I mean, the document, now that's an EMAP. The problem I had was with University of Rhode Island. So that was a little different. But, it would be easy enough to do it, but, I mean, we're hoping to expand cooperative research, so we need to at least take in that concern.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. And, matter of fact, Sustainable Fisheries does provide us copies of all the FPs and LOAs. The VMS team is on the distribution for those. And they're also populated in a database there in Gloucester that we can refer back to. So, in terms of just to add on, in terms of fishing on a day at sea trip in and out of the demarcation line, fishing both sides of the line on a trip, I'm not talking about the cooperative research program, just general day at sea fishing trip. We remind people to call in and use the IVR call-in system. Put DOF to clear out a fishery in your VMS units on and positioning, but they declare their trip through the IVR. Because as you said, the VMS is going to start the trip multiple times as you're crossing the line.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you. Vince, I understand you've got a proposal to solve the fluke problem that you're going to present right now. Is that right?
Oh, that's not right.
Okay. I have bad information then. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to be back here for my semi-annual attendance at the New England Fishery Management Council. The commission met in February, Mr. Chairman, and Paul Howard has put a report of that meeting in your briefing book behind tab 1, agenda item 5. There's a couple of items I'd folks might be interested in that report. One is we received a report of the peer-reviewed striped bass stock assessment. It indicates that the stock continues to be healthy. In fact, it's about 42% over the target spawning stock biomass, and the fishing mortality is well below the threshold. And in that report, Mr. Chairman, if you look through that, it's some interesting numbers on what the recreational harvest and commercial harvest is, as well as the note that our total harvest of that stock has gone up by 46% since 2002. So a real good example of what the potential of a rebuilt stock can do for both commercial and recreational harvesters. There's also a note in that report that the commission found New Jersey out of compliance with the TOTOG plan. That finding was reinforced by the Secretary of Commerce, who took action to close New Jersey's TOTOG fishery by the 1st of April. And with the notification from the Secretary, New Jersey took action to come back into compliance prior to the Secretary having to enforce the closure. So New Jersey is back in compliance. And the third item in there that may be of interest is Commission continues to move forward on a public information document regarding river herring. As you probably know, Mr. Chairman, up and down the coast there's been precipitous drops in local runs of river herring. And while a stock assessment is still several years off, there's some interest at the Commission of responding at least to the drop and landing. So we're continuing to look at that. And I was encouraged to see in the bycatch reporting plan that we're going to move forward to expand collecting data on bycatch that's going on in the directed Atlantic herring fishery. On the next item, Mr. Chairman, is the Commission will be meeting on May 5th through 8th in Alexandria, Virginia. There's a small item in there on our Coastal Sharks board, and the item is just sort of an innocuous quota management discussion. The original intent of that agenda item was to review the current seasonal and spatial management plan that we have and to see how that has affected state-by-state landings over the years. That was the original intent when that agenda item was scheduled. Since then, we've received a letter from Director of Marine Fisheries in North Carolina requesting that we expand that discussion to consideration of state-by-state quotas for spiny dogfish. So that's an issue that I know is of going to be of interest to some of the states here at this council. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Commission meetings are open to the public, and they're at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Alexandria. So thanks very much for your hospitality. I'm happy to be here, and I'll be here through Thursday. Thank you.
Thanks, Vince. At the NRCC meeting, I think it was last week or the week before, I can't remember, we had a discussion concerning an effort that the ASMFC is undertaking, which involves the joint management of species between the commission and either the MID or the New England Council. And I just wanted to make this council aware, and I may put my foot in my mouth or state it improperly, but there's going to be some sort of an effort or a workshop that you're going to coordinate to bring the ASMSC and both councils together to have a discussion about the overlapping management plans. And I didn't know if you felt comfortable describing it beyond what I just did to the council, just to give them an understanding of what you have in mind.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. No, I think you've done a good job. The problem or the issue comes up a little bit more in the Mid-Atlantic, where we have particularly in the summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass plan. But I think we had an example of that issue with Atlantic herring and the 1A, potential 1A disconnect. Now, eventually it was resolved, but it's to get at issues like that. And quite frankly, as both the New England Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council move forward in having to comply with annual catch limits and accountability measures, in some of these joint plans, the councils are going to be operating to one set of standards, and the commission, quite frankly, needs to come to grips with how we're going to deal with that. And I think a key issue of the NRC discussion, and Paul Howard's brought this out, is that it's really important that what the states do not undermine what the councils are trying to do with their harvest. So I think all this sort of fits together, and we have a committee at the commission, and as we said at NRCC, we'll be moving forward to work with you all on that. So thanks for bringing that up. I think it's an important topic.
Okay. Anything further for Vince? Dr. Pierce.
Just a quick point regarding what Vince said about the need for better coordination for us to work closer together, that is the Council and ASMFC, and I highlight that because of what Vince just said about sea herring. To give an excellent example, we're going to talk about sea herring either tomorrow or the day after, and it's all about a particular amendment, the next amendment to the plan. And you know, the herring committee met and developed recommendations for us to consider tomorrow, but it was a meeting that did not involve the sea herring section. And there are issues here that cut across to section ASMFC issues, ASMFC concerns, sector management, for example. So that has to be resolved. It seems to me that it makes a lot of sense for us to have the section meet with the herring committee. Otherwise, there's the potential for a very serious disconnect and some friction between ASMFC and the council.
Anything else? Okay, I guess that concludes our reports. The next agenda item before lunch is review of experimental fishery permit applications, tab 13. I think Chris is going to lead that discussion.